Call the House Transportation Committee light, I guess, to order. And until we have a quorum, we'll just probably go ahead and do public hearings. And I'm going to go ahead and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 728.
Madam Chair, members, Senate Bill 728A repeals the sunset on provisions allowing qualified persons between 2080 vision and 2200 vision who use a bioptic lens device to drive with additional training and under restricted conditions. It deletes the restrictions on such low vision drivers that currently limits them to roads with speed limits of 45 miles per hour or less. It allows nighttime driving for low vision bioptic lens drivers, but only if a doctor certifies every 2 years that the person can safely drive at night and if the driver obtains additional training for night driving. It would finally sunset the nighttime driving allowance in 4 years. We have received a no revenue and minimal fiscal impact on this particular measure. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Judith. I'm going to go ahead and call up Aaron Matthews and Aaron Matthews from Joseph. I was looking for two names. It's Josephine County, right?
Good afternoon. Now, do I need to wait for Senator Atkinson to be here for this?
Was he going to be here with you?
Yes, someone was going to get him out of committee right now.
Well, tell us about your life then.
Yeah.
Well, about 13 years ago, I couldn't see very well. I was having trouble reading. My mom took me to the eye doctor, and I had to go through 8 hours of testing, at which point the doctor diagnosed me with a rare form of macular degeneration, which he walked in the room and said, "You're legally blind. You'll never drive, you'll never play sports, and you'll never be able to succeed in school," basically. And at that point, I didn't really realize that for the rest of my life that I was really going to be defined by that word blind, and that's what everybody was going to look at me and see, and that's what they were going to assess my abilities off of, basically by that word. So I went through my life, and at a certain point I realized that I wasn't going to let that define me, that blind was only a word, and I was going to succeed at whatever I chose to. Last year I graduated from the University of Oregon with a degree in history. I'm currently in a master's program getting my degree in education right now. I've played sports my entire life. My senior year, my basketball team placed fourth at the state 4A basketball championships in Portland. And basically the last thing on the list that I have not been able to accomplish was getting full driving privileges for people with low vision. The first time around, this law was very difficult to pass. Granted, people were very scared when they heard the words blind and driving in the same sentence, which I can understand. If I was in your position, I would feel the very same way. Not being able to understand what someone else can see is very difficult. But the most difficult thing I would say is not understanding what someone can see and then placing your own value on what they can see or what they can do. It was difficult to get passed, but the great thing was that we did get it passed, although there were some things that we had to give up, being the restrictions on daytime driving, speed limit, and the sunset clause. Once again, those things were understandable, being the situation that it was. These past 4 years have been a great time because I believe that it gave us the greatest opportunity to have a test group. One of the most difficult things was when passing the last law, people said, well, there's not a good test. You know, there hasn't been any great test run on this sort of driving application, and we don't have a lot of evidence. Well, over the last 4 years, we've had a great amount of evidence, and there's been 16 drivers that have either been had a permit or a license under this law, and there's only been, what, excuse me?
How many?
There's been 16 drivers that either have a license or permit under this current law. And in the last 4 years, there's only been one minor accident and two tickets. And I would have to say that I'm responsible for one of those tickets. I blame it on my driving instructor. He told me that U-turns were permitted if you were late for Spanish class. So I took that to heart. Basically, over these last 4 years, we've proven that this law is safe. We've proven that we have the ability to drive safely, and that is the main point that we wanted to show to you guys today. For this next law, we are asking for increased privileges. We understand that driving is a right. It is not a privilege, that's why we're not asking for increased rights, but rather we want the opportunity to demonstrate that we can be safe drivers and that we have the ability to drive safely. One of the things that I love about this bill is that it has a lot of checks and balances built into it. To put an unsafe driver on the road, so many people would have to fundamentally fail at their job. First of all, a low vision specialist would have to put someone through the process that does not have the vision requirements or does not have the general ability to become a safe driver. Then a driver's training specialist wouldn't have to certify that they are a safe driver when in fact they are in some way not. And lastly, they would have to pass a driving test at the DMV. If a person was an unsafe driver, if they could not see, they would not be able to make it through all these different checks. There are so many different hoops you have to jump through that to put an unsafe driver on the road, it would be nearly impossible, I think. Out of all the drivers in the state of Oregon, I and the people under this law have had to go through the most rigorous and strenuous application process. And that's what it is. We're not given the right to drive. We're given the right to apply for a license. Most people go in and they don't read the booklet. They take the test and they're out on the road the next day with their permit, having no prior knowledge, having no experience. We have to have 30 hours behind the wheel training while taking driver safety courses. And I believe that by the time that we are driving, we are in fact safer than the average driver. I would like to explain to you guys the freedom that a law like this allows to a person of low vision, the mobility that it gives you, and I don't think that I can accurately do that in words. I would just like you guys to understand that it goes from having a person who is limited to staying in their house to getting rides from other people, especially in Oregon where it's a very rural state. People lack the opportunity for public transportation unless you live in, you know, Portland or Eugene or Salem. It gives people the opportunity to become productive citizens. And I guess what I would ask of you all is to not be another group of people that bases their decision off the perceptions of people's abilities, but rather just give us a chance to demonstrate how safe we can be. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions here?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Buckley.
Thank you very much. I'm interested in the bioptic telescopic lens and how that works for you in your driving. Do you use it, is it constantly there with you, or are you looking through it constantly? Or
no, you don't look through. That's one of the common misconceptions, is that what the glasses basically are is they're a clear lens set of glasses, and over whichever is your strongest eye, they will drill a hole and implant a bioptic lens in there. So you're not, it's above your vision, actually, and you're not looking through it the entire time. The best way I can describe it, and I heard this described this way before I used it, and it didn't really crystallize until I actually used it, is that you use it like you look in your mirrors. When you're driving, you're constantly checking your back mirror, your rearview mirror, your side mirrors, checking the zones around you. When you're driving, that's how you guys use your central vision, is you check the road ahead of you, just like someone checks in the mirror. Well, that's a kind of a seamless transition for you guys to do it naturally. And this way, the glasses supplant the central vision that we have lost. And you just glance down, you tilt your head forward, which pulls the bioptic into view, and you look ahead for just a second. Now, what most people are afraid of is they think that the central vision is essential to driving, when in fact, about 98% of the time, you're using your peripheral vision. And the central vision, I mean, if you hold your arms out to the side, that's 180 degrees of vision, which most people have. Your central vision is only the center 3 degrees. And most people get locked into that, which makes them an unsafe driver. And so really, the best way I can describe it is if you were looking into a mirror, if you glance through it for just a second, you're looking at what's around you, you're not driving looking through it. You're driving using the peripheral vision that most people use the entire time also.
Interesting. Thank you.
I didn't see no other questions, so thank you for coming. We really appreciate it, and I'm assuming that Senator Atkinson is not making it. Does his office have any comments or? Okay. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
And Jack Evans.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Jack Evans of the Department of Transportation. This was a bill that was initiated in 2003, and the program came about through the work of an advisory committee that included vision specialists and occupational therapists, driving instructors, various other individuals, and put together a set of criteria for the Bioptic Lens Limited Vision Driving Program. The program does, under current law, require that an individual have a certificate of vision specialist certifying that they meet the standards for the program, and that they undergo special training with a specially trained rehabilitation training a program specialist and get a certificate of competency. And therefore, they're able to test with DMV to get a limited vision driving permit and or a driver's license. They're restricted under the current law to driving with the bioptic lens only during daylight hours and only on roads that with speeds that are not greater than 45 miles an hour. There are 16, as was mentioned, 16 participants in the program now. 12 are licensed. 4 have permits. The record of the program, there's been 2 convictions for traffic offenses and one accident. Virtually all the other states have some type of a limited driving program. 34 other states have programs that employ the bioptic lens. And in looking at the statistics from the other states, there's about 15 that have daylight restrictions and only about 3 or 4 that have the restrictions, as Oregon does, on the driving on roads with speeds of 45 miles an hour or greater. Not greater than 45 miles an hour. When this bill was heard in the Senate, it was amended to lift the restriction on the 45-mile-an-hour roads and to put in place a sort of a sub-pilot for nighttime driving, which would sunset in 2011, and that would require special training, as well as having a vision specialist certify that there weren't any particular problems with an individual's night vision that would prohibit them from driving at night. So we thought at DMV that even though we're neutral on the measure, that seemed like a fair compromise, and we don't have any problems with it. So I will answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jack, Section 8 of the Ingress Bill does require an examination every 2 years by a licensed vision specialist, and I'm just assuming that that certification is turned over to Toyota Motor Vehicles after it's done. I'm not quite sure what the process would be.
Chair by Representative Buckley, that's correct. They'll get a certificate from the individual who will then and that certificate will be brought to DMV to recertify them. For the normal program, the larger program, they have to come back and recertify by taking a driving test as well.
Thank you.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Jack, I just want to understand. So they have to go through extra testing, right?
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, they have to go through additional training and certification from a vision specialist. The testing is then every 2 years for this particular certificate. So in the sense that, as opposed to a normal driver's license, this would be additional.
So follow-up? So the training that they have to go through, that's not done by ODOT. That's private training that they have to contract for. Is that correct?
That is correct, Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, that the private industry takes care of that training. DMV, when the program was initiated, I believe, brought in a specialist from another state in this type of training, in limited vision training, and they trained about 10 individuals. And I don't know exactly how many are currently still instructing at this time. There's at least 3 of them. And so they are specially trained individuals.
Follow-up?
Follow-up.
So do they have special certification, and if so, from whom?
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, that, I'm not sure if they have a special certification. They would be recognized as rehabilitation training specialists by DMV. And so they would have to have, I believe they are certified by DMV to demonstrate that they've at least had this training by the specialist.
Do we have anybody from DMV here today?
Yeah.
I thought you were ODOT.
Well, DMV is part of ODOT, and I represent DMV, and motor carrier is my specialties.
Okay, Jack, thank you. Okay, you think that they have a special certification from DMV, correct?
That is correct. They have to have special training, and whether or not there's a certificate presented to them, I don't know the exact process, but I can certainly find out.
Okay, I'd appreciate that. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. It's looking like this bill is going to be carried over until Wednesday anyway, but so if there's specific questions that you want answered, we'll go ahead and make sure we get those answered. Thank you.
Anyone else who's testifying?
Well,
I know besides the senator, anybody else?
Oh.
Okay.
Senator Atkinson, you have a hard act to follow, but your constituent did a great job.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Madam Chair, for the record, Jason Atkinson, State Senator from Southern Oregon. I recall when I was in the House of Representatives, I came up for a bill to testify, and the good chair, like you, said, do you want to testify or do you want to have the bill move? And it was a choice I was given, so I am certainly at your pleasure. I would like to see the bill move. And I believe that Mr. Matthews has spoken.
Yes.
Okay. Would it be helpful for you to understand how Senator Courtney and I got involved in this issue? Would that be interesting to you?
Yes. Well, we don't have a quorum. We're waiting, so.
Because, Madam Chair, there's an issue that involves you in this particular bill.
Uh-huh.
So allow me to take my coat off and throw it in a mud puddle for you to walk across. Years ago, I met this guy named Aaron Matthews. And Aaron was a senior in high school. Yeah?
Yeah.
He was also on track team. He's also on basketball. And he had a senior project, and the senior project essentially was, how is he going to change the law dealing with this concept of bioptics and limited sight and all these issues. And, well, long story short, I went to his high school to speak at his class. And as we were walking out, I told Mr. Matthews, I said, well, you've just got the senator there, so that pretty much iced the fact that you're going to get an A. I mean, that's pretty good. But if you really want to do this, come see me next year, and we will work together. And he, at the time, was going to Chemehuevka Community College, and he came up with this bill, which was known at the time as the Bioptic Bill. President Courtney, then Senator Courtney, had just had Marla Runyon give the commencement address at Western Oregon University. Marla was an Olympic athlete who suffered from the same condition that Aaron did, who was able to drive when she was training for the Olympics in California, but had since moved to Eugene, was unable because we hadn't changed the law or had this on the books. And so we built this very interesting coalition of my friend Peter Courtney and I and Marla Runyon and the can-do guy who I believe will serve in this body at some point, Aaron Matthews. And we started through this very long trek of senators behind my back and sometimes to my face saying, oh, you're letting blind people drive. And it became this bill that people made fun of, but a few people actually understood what we were doing, as I'm sure Mr. Matthews has just described. And it became one of those bills that I have to confess, my complete heart was invested in. Same was Peter Courtney. And so here he and I are working for this very small population of people who wanted the same privilege that we all have, with the same rights that are afforded to residents that live in the states that surround our state. And so it became Aaron Matthews and me and Peter Courtney against the world. And long story short, we got it through the Senate. We got the bill to the got through the committee. And the committee didn't want to pass it out, but through some work that senators do, we were able to get it out of committee. We moved to the floor, and we got it out of the floor, and we went to the House, and the same thing happened. And so I had Republicans in the House saying some ill things about the bill, and the same thing was happening in the Democratic caucus. Peter went to their caucus. I went to the Republican caucus. We got the thing to the floor. It comes up on the floor, and it dies. And it dies big. It dies huge big. It died unanimous no votes. I mean, I've never seen this happen. And the grateful chair, who is now the chair, changed her vote for possible reconsideration. It was Representative Beyer who changed the vote. So I'm at the place that we rent in Salem, and I get this phone call from Peter Courtney that, if you know President Courtney, you know he's very animated. Well, his animations in person were doubled on the phone that day, as he was calling me things and very upset, and how come you people, and I was upset, and how come your people, and back and forth. And because of the chair, we had about 24 hours. And long story short, again, the bill passes, it comes up for reconsideration, and the next day it passes unanimously. That's right. It's a pretty big day, pretty big win. It goes to the governor's office, and the same thing happens then. The governor's going to kill the bill for a whole variety of reasons. Long story short, it became law. Well, last year I was trying to get the people of Oregon to sign me up for a different job. And while I was working for that particular campaign, this guy walks in, this guy that just testified. And now he's not in high school. Now he's engaged and pursuing a master's degree to become a teacher. So let me check. See your left hand. Now, as he comes to you before you, you have a full-fledged adult husband about to be teacher, who is still interested in this bill. And what the bill does that's before you now is it simply says that what we've done earlier was a great success and allows for two changes. One, having to do with getting the foot in the door for privileges in non-daylight hours, and also the 45 mile an hour and some of the other restrictions that we put on the bill originally. We were able to get the bill through the House, compromise, but I bring it to you. And I know that's kind of a long story, Vice Chair and Madam Chair and Representative, but this is one of my favorite all-time things, because the Matthews and Aaron is just a contagious guy all around. And as you probably saw, he's a fantastically articulate person that I hope becomes a senator someday. So with that long 4-minute history, thank you again for changing your vote, which led to a dramatic turnaround, and here we are today to fix the bill.
Thank you. Any questions for the senator?
I have one, Senator.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you. What exactly did you put in the water the day you got the unanimous vote? I want to get some of that.
Well, Representative, I'm just a simple country boy. Let's just say I learned a thing or two along the way.
Well, just a
but it was dramatic. It was from complete devastation to complete success. Yeah.
In 24 hours. Well, I wish we had a quorum to vote this bill through today. Thank you. I really appreciate the bill.
It's a great bill. And these people that have been affected by the original bill are overly responsible. It is one of those opportunities where, and if you've just met and you just have Aaron Matthews, I think his life mantra is, give me a chance, I'll show you what I can do. And every time anyone in his whole life has given him a chance. He doesn't just meet expectations. He exceeds them so beyond what anyone else can think of that he's unstoppable. I think that this eye condition has taught him the kind of man he's going to be, which I think needs to be in public service. I'm going to keep saying that on the record because his mother's here over and over and over until he decides to run. Thank you very much, Madam
Thank
Chair.
You. Thank you for coming in. I'm going to go ahead and close the public.
Not, please. Close the hearing. Thank you.
Oh, sorry.
Yes. I am a skeptic, and so I need more information, and maybe we can get it today, or maybe we can get it in the future. But my mother had macular degeneration, and I have a couple of close friends who had macular degeneration. So it's just hard for me to understand. Aaron, I think you are a wonderful young man, and I'm sure you've done a wonderful job, but I can't visualize this, and I know that's my problem. But I'm going to need some convincing and more information, so I'm not sure if you want to help provide it today or if we will get it in the future.
Yes, you may.
Yeah, I would love to provide any information you can. One of the difficulties was that we didn't find out that the bill was being heard in this committee until Friday afternoon. So many of the doctors and people that are affected by this law weren't able to come today. While you're saying that you can, what is your specific question as far as your difficulty visualizing how this works?
My mother had trouble moving at all, much less being able to drive. She wasn't able to drive. So it's just hard for me to understand how it is. I understand you wear special glasses and that helps your peripheral vision. I just can't get it in my head how that works.
Okay, well,
and I'm going to get there's two parts of that, if I may, Madam Chair.
Yes.
As I've gotten older, it's harder for me to drive at nights, and it's especially if it's wet. And the fact, I guess, that you are wanting to extend this is even more confusing to me. Right.
Well, let me try to answer both of those questions. Okay. First of all, as I stated earlier, when you are driving, 98% of what you're doing is with your peripheral vision, which is what those of us with macular degeneration have. And in most cases, our peripheral vision is honed to a sense that most people probably do not have. For that other 2% of the time, which is basically used for looking ahead to see a road sign, looking ahead to see a stop sign, a stoplight, what an obstruction in the road, you glance and use the glasses just as you use your central vision. But with your eyes automatically, it's like having a camera, your eyes automatically focus in and use your central vision and go back out and use your peripheral vision without any sort of transition. It does it seamlessly in a way that is kind of difficult because for someone such as yourself, it's hard to understand how my eyes don't do that. The bioptic supplants that central vision that you have. It does the exact same thing. It's the one of the biggest difficulties that I learned through my driving program. One of the reasons people do not understand this is because most people drive incorrectly. Most people drive using their central vision. They focus in on something, and it's basically like rolling up a newspaper and looking through it while you're driving. They've blocked everything else out and are only looking at one small area straight ahead, when in fact that makes them a very unsafe driver. Secondly, as I stated before, the reason that this is a safe law is because there are so many checks and balances. I mean, if the law stated that you could allow someone who is completely blind to drive, it would still be safe because someone who is unsafe could not make it through all these checks and balances, all the certification processes. It just couldn't happen. To speak to the nighttime driving that you were discussing, the nighttime restriction, to be honest, made me angry this last time through because it has no medical or factual basis to it. Your eye is basically made up of rods and cones, which are photoreceptors. So when images come in, they are processed through these photoreceptors. Now, in your central vision, it's made up of mostly cones, which is for obviously distance, being able to see things far away, Now, what the rods are used for, which are mostly in your peripheral vision, is sensitive motion detection, light sensitivity, and your peripheral vision. That is what you use to drive the entire time. That is what we have. The part of the vision that you see with at night is all that we have. And so the peripheral vision is what you use at night to see well. And I believe that I'm a safer driver at night. And the doctors that have come to testify in the Senate agree that people with macular degeneration see better at night than in the day.
Interesting. You know, it would be helpful to me. I know there's a doctor's report in here. I guess we need the same kind of information that was sent to the Senate. And also information on the kind of the certification that you go through, Aaron. That would be helpful to me. What exactly that means and how someone gets certified to do the certification.
Okay.
And it would help me to know, too, the people I've known who've had macular degeneration who are elderly, it got worse over time. And I'd like to know whether the macular degeneration that you have, whether or not it gets worse over time. So I guess what I'd like, and maybe someone can get that for the committee, is information from an ophthalmologist regarding the kind of disease that you and these other 16 people or 15 people have.
Okay, can I answer that last question quickly? As far as my form of macular degeneration, most elderly people have a degenerative form of macular degeneration which continually gets worse. My vision went from 20/20 to 20/200 in a matter of 2 months. And it has stayed, since I was 9 years old, it has stayed exactly the same. Now, a doctor could tell you better than I, but when it has stayed the same for such a period of time, the likelihood that it will ever change again is like 1%. That is the reason why there is such constant exams by the eye doctor. Every 2 years we have to go to a specialist as far as an eye doctor to specify that we are safe, and every 2 years we must go through a driving exam again to specify that we are safe at driving as well.
Follow up. So the other 15 people, Aaron, do they have the same condition that you do?
They don't have the same condition, but they have similar results. I know that you have testimony from Brandon Johnson today, and I know that he has ocular albinism, and I can't tell you specifics about his condition, but I know that they all result in some sort of macular degeneration.
Okay.
So a low vision specialist could specify the likelihood that their vision will change, and that's a huge factor that they take into account when they make the decision of whether it is safe to put them on the road or not, is whether or not their condition is stable or whether it is kind of a fluid condition that could change at any time.
Right. That would be helpful for me to know. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Aaron, when you get your permit and you're working with a driver instructor, you're required to go through the same number of hours or more hours than a 16 or 17-year-old who does not have the vision challenge?
To my knowledge right now, a 16 or 17-year-old does not have to go through any sort of driver's training whatsoever. What the program was like is I was put into basically a typical driver's training program here in Salem, and I had to take a driver safety course, and along with that, the people that were in that course would have 6 hours of behind-the-wheel training.
Right.
I had to have no less than 30 hours of behind-the-wheel training, and at that point, they could either specify that I was safe to drive, give me their stamp of approval, or it could go more, unlimited. So it is at least 30 hours of behind-the-wheel training. Then, if you are deemed safe, then you're given your instructional permit for a period of time. Then you may apply for your license. So by the time I was done with my permit and with my training, I had had more driver's training than most people will ever have in their entire lives.
Very good. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Jack, I have a quick question if you wouldn't mind coming up. Thank you. Do you have any idea of the range of ages of people that these 16 people cover?
Madam Chair, Jack Evans with the Department of Transportation. Yes, I do. They are, of the 16 people, six of them are under 30, and 10 of them are over 30, or 30 or over, 30 years of age or over.
So, do you have the
specific breakdown that I was hunting for here. There are six that are in the age range of 18 to 30 years old. There's two that are in the range of 31 to 50 years. There's seven individuals that are 51 to 65, and then there's an individual that's over 70.
Could I have a
question? Thank you. Jack, what does Oregon's law, is it similar to California's and Washington's?
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, let me take a look at my sheet here. California does have a bioptic lens law, and it is similar in to Oregon's in the vision standards that are utilized. There is no nighttime restriction in California, nor is there a restriction on road speed as there is in Oregon, the 45-mile-an-hour restriction. In the state of Washington, they also have a very similar vision standard to Oregon's. They do require the use of the bioptic lens. They do not have a daylight-only restriction, so they don't have the nighttime. It's allowed in the state of Washington. And they also do not have the restriction on the road speed that Oregon has. Only about three other states have the road speed restriction, and about 15 have some type of a nighttime restriction out of all 50 states.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
And I will turn in my written testimony, which I forgot about.
So. Okay. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 728A, and we'll carry this one over until Wednesday and see if we can get everybody's concerns addressed before we do anything. And thank you so much for coming and for your testimony. Okay. I'm going to go ahead and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 101. I don't have anyone signed up for this, but we do have, and we probably at this rate aren't going to be able to move it, but I did want to address a couple amendments that we have today and maybe get a little public input on them. Before we close the public hearing. So, Judith.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Senate Bill 101A is the measure that phases in new permit and training requirements for Class 1 and Class 3 all-terrain vehicle operators, beginning with those under the age of 16. You do have before you two amendments. One we talked about last week, the -A6 amendments from the Cattlemen's Association, which exempts from ATV requirements all-terrain vehicles used exclusively for farming, agricultural operations, forestry operations, or used by persons licensed for nursery and Christmas tree operations. And the further exempts ATVs being used on land owned or leased by the owner of the vehicle. You have now before you the -A7 amendments. Those deal with a different section of law dealing with helmets. It requires an ATV operator under the age of 18 to wear a helmet with a fastened chin strap. It does have similar exemptions for ATV operators. They're exempted from these requirements, again, if the vehicle is being used exclusively for farming, agricultural operations, forestry operations, nursery or Christmas tree growing operations. Here we've included the old utility employee exemption as well, as we had discussed in a previous bill. House Bill 2062, and it also, and similarly, exemption would apply in all cases when an ATV is being used to load or unload the vehicle from a truck or trailer. And this, I will remind you that this particular measure does have a referral to Ways and Means. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Judith. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and invite someone up from Parks and and Lindy, if you wouldn't mind coming up, and the dealers, and I'm sorry, I apologize, the name is gone right now.
Okay.
Yeah, April, thank you. So we can maybe just get a little feedback on amendments.
Oregon Power Sports Association, also representing Oregon Vehicle Dealer Associations, and we have no problems with the amendments. The chin strap is fine. All the cattlemen's is also okay.
Thank you.
My name is Minton, and I also agree those amendments are perfectly fine for myself and our group as well, the rider group. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Myron with the State Parks Department, and the A6 amendment is the amendment that we promised to the Cattlemen's Association that we would get in when the bill was heard in the Senate side. So that's the that would take care of that. The A7 amendment is not ours, but it's language that came from House Bill 2062, and as we supported that bill, there's no reason for us to not support the same language here, unless for some reason it doesn't. You know, it would make this bill so heavy that it would collapse. Other than that, thank you.
Okay. I have something. As I understand it, there's already a helmet bill in place for children. Anyone under the age of 18 is required on public lands to wear a helmet. So this is only addressing the chin strap, and essentially without the chin strap, the helmet is of no benefit to a child.
Thank you. I tend to agree. any question for this group? Or?
Yes. Thank you.
Representative Tomei.
I guess on Amendment A7, I don't know if you have that with you. And maybe this question is to you. It's in line 10. It says the requirement to wear a motorcycle helmet does not apply if the ATV is used exclusively in farming, et cetera. Licensed for nursery tree farming or an employee of a utility, the only people required to use a helmet would be those under 18. So would any of those people be hired by a utility? I guess what I'm trying to understand is...
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Tomei, you do have a good eagle eye there, and that is when I put in the amendment request on this particular measure dealing with the chin strap for those under 18, I just asked for those amendments for the farming, agriculture, forestry, nurseryman, and tree, Christmas tree growing operations from a previous amendment to a bill that came through the committee. I'm not sure why Heidi included that, because her and I did have a discussion in Legislative Council that the utility exemption probably wouldn't need to apply since these are indeed for those under the age of 18. But the way it came out, it happens to be in there.
Well, then, so let me ask these folks. I'm assuming that you would like to see anyone 18, or is it under 18? Under 18. Mm-hmm. Wear a helmet, correct? So what this seems to be saying is that if you are working in farming or agricultural or forestry or an employee of a utility, that you wouldn't have to wear a helmet, even if you were under 18. Would you agree with that?
May I answer?
Yes, please.
I live on a small farm. My children and I, and their father on Sundays, clean the barn. My children are scooping, throwing it in a cart, and sometimes they'll actually be the one that will drive it 75 feet and unload it into our garden and come back. But it's very difficult to have a helmet and clean stalls at the same time. And that's just from our point of view. My children aren't allowed to ride on our farm, generally speaking, unless we're together and we're doing the barn cleaning. And again, it's the on and off with the helmet, with the shovel, and also with the hearing, with the cows and everything else that's going on. In addition, I don't believe that the Farm Bureau would support it because there's a lot of agricultural communities on private property where the children are working on the farms.
Okay. Thank you.
Just to clarify, the existing helmet requirement includes these exclusions already, except for the utility one.
Right. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Is there anyone else that would have any comments on these amendments?
May I introduce my children? Last time I was here, you had said, you know, an 11-year-old on one of the larger size bikes. I would like to introduce my son and my daughter, and you'll understand why one size doesn't fit all. Sometimes they grow a little faster than their parents do. Jacob and Jenny? They're going to kill me later.
I know.
Yes. I'm not going to get any help on Sunday cleaning the barn. I guarantee you. As you can see, a small bike wouldn't work for them, and that's why they're on a bike that they can appropriately operate. So
may
thank
I
you.
Respond?
Yeah.
My concern was not the size, but a child can be very large, and yet she or he is still a child. So my concern was a child operating vehicles that are very heavy and have a lot of horsepower and can be dangerous. So it was not so much the size as the vehicle itself. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you so much for coming.
Madam Chair, Randy Nicolay. Just quick clarification on the A7. If you're loading and unloading the vehicle, you're not required to have a helmet if you're under age 18. Or if you're under 18 and you are loading the trailer, that helmet still has to be on, correct?
I don't think there's an exemption on this.
I'm just kind of wondering about some of the statistics about loading and unloading. It's usually a very dangerous time with the vehicle, especially in some of the lower cargo trailers, et cetera, these days, too, and head clearances.
On page 2, I'm sure.
Okay.
It
does have the exemption.
Yeah. It does.
Have a concern about that?
I'd have a concern about that, yes.
Okay.
It's just a very dangerous time when you have a vehicle going onto the ramp and going on over the other side. So it should have a helmet on, I would think, still at that point.
Would you please identify yourself, because I didn't ask you to do that?
Randy Nicolay, president of ATV Ride,
okay.
Support Riders Club.
All right. Thank you. We'll certainly make note of that.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 101 and open a public hearing on SJR 15.
Madam Chair, members, Senate Joint Resolution 15 declares legislative support for the Columbia River Crossing Project. It recognizes that the project will require strong partnership among all levels of government, the private sector, and citizens of Oregon and Washington. It recognizes the importance of various modes of transportation, as well as the environment, businesses, and neighborhoods affected. Declares support for the continuation of bi-state and bipartisan efforts in planning, coordinating, and funding the project, and for the cooperation of the federal government in providing funding and streamlining of the regulatory process. We have a no fiscal and no revenue impact on this measure. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Judith. And Doug Tindall.
Good afternoon, Chair Byer, members of the committee. I'm Doug Tindall, Deputy Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. The Columbia River Crossing Project is a bi-state transit and highway improvement project that Oregon Department of Transportation and Washington Department of Transportation are undertaking together. The resolution describes the importance of the Columbia River crossing and the needs for improvement, congestion, mobility, safety, all problems that we face today over that bridge. Bill calls for continued cooperation, bi-state cooperation. We're fortunate enough to be working well with the Washington Department of Transportation and intend to do so. This brings that into law or brings it into a resolution to ensure that the legislature has clearly made the statement that they want us to continue to work together. Right now, the project is scheduled to obtain a record of decision, that's an environmental document, from the Federal Highway Administration in mid to late 2009. We will select, or targeting to select, what's called the locally preferred alternative in 2008. That will sort of define exactly what the project is. We don't have funding identified yet. We do have funding identified through the environmental impact statement. However, to get to construction, we do not yet have funding identified. And this resolution, again, clearly states the importance of the Columbia River crossing and recognizes, I think, that we're going to have to turn on many different faucets to draw money for this expensive project. So the Columbia River project is moving forward at a very fast pace when compared to other large transportation projects going through the EIS process. Even with the additional challenges of bi-state and FTA, FHWA coordination, FTA is the Federal Transit Administration, FHWA is the Federal Highway Administration, and they need to coordinate, as this is both a highway and transit project, just as Oregon and Washington need to coordinate. To position the Columbia River crossing for funding in the next authorization bill, we must take steps now to ensure that the funding gaps to complete the EIS work are met and make provisions to fund the final engineering right away, utility relocation, and construction phases of the project. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions?
Well, Madam Chair, it's hard to, you know, argue against cooperation between states and federal and state government. And I know it's controversial, but I'm for this bill.
It might be more than you think.
Clue me in if it is.
Yes. Well, Representative Tomei, any questions? Or any
I've got lots of questions. So one of the concerns that I've heard expressed, Doug, is that just lots of different alternatives have been excluded. And I'm just glancing briefly at this, and it looks like we're looking at five alternatives, right?
Chair Beyer, Representative Tomei, that's correct. And I wouldn't say necessarily excluded. I'd say they've been investigated. In the written testimony, describes the process of the project committee and the amount of input they've taken, literally thousands of the project task force and literally thousands of people have been part of this project. There are, at this point, continuing into the environmental impact study, five, as you said, five alternatives. What's called a replacement bridge, which totally replaces where the other two structures are removed, and then a supplemental bridge where the one or both of the structures would remain, and there would be another bridge built to supplement those two structures, along with the no-build option. No-build's always an option in an environmental study.
Madam Chair, I, as you know, that part of my background was being in the Planning Commission for many years and then on city government and then coming into the legislature. And a lot of my concern about this is land use planning. And I guess one of my concerns is that I don't have a lot of interest in making it easier for people to buy less expensive homes in the southern Washington and make it easier for them to get back and forth to travel and to their jobs over a bridge that we have to finance. And Washington State, the Vancouver area especially, has been resistant to light rail over coming into Oregon. And it seems to me I would have a hard time supporting the billions of dollars that this will cost without seeing light rail and without seeing Washington State, the people who have decided to live there and work in Oregon, take a lot of responsibility for the cost of this. It has to be done, obviously. We have truckers here. I know it's a huge issue, and trucking is going to get more congestion. But to me, a lot of my concern is around land use planning. So I've got lots of questions,
yes,
but probably nothing needs to be asked today.
Thank you. I guess one really quick question, and looking through there, I did actually go up to the meeting where the Senate passed this, but this basically just says that we want to continue working together to try to find a solution.
That's
right.
Chair Beyer, that's my reading of this resolution.
Thank you. And thank you for coming. And I'm going to close the public hearing on SJR 15. And before I close the committee, I'm trying to decide if I should just carry all these bills over till Wednesday or just reschedule them. We only have two more meetings after this anyways. So
we only have two more meetings?
Last week in committee.
Oh, so we've got two meetings this
week. Well, or we could meet on Friday afternoon at 3 for Memorial Day weekend. I'm sure that would go well. So two.
That's
right. So I'm going to go ahead and carry SJR 15 and Senate Bill 728A and Senate Bill 101A over until Wednesday.
Great.
And then I'm going to close the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, and thank you for coming.
You bet.